2017 is coming to a close. Was it a good year? We'll find out next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Barry, as always. And as you can hear, we shouldn't be busy, but we are today. So you can probably hear my phone ringing in the background. I meant to turn it off and I forgot.
No, that's perfectly fine. You know what? Again, this kind of sets with our theme. 2017 was actually starting to become a better year for business.
Yes. I agree.
You know, there were, you know, during the early part of the year, we had, you know, the transition from the previous administration to the Trump administration. And we've had all the things that have happened, including mass shootings in the U.S., terror attacks, things of that nature. But however, in economic terms, things seem to be looking up. So I your ringing phones, Chuck, in the background, are a sign and a symbol of the fact that 2017 wasn't really that bad of a year.
I'll be quite honest. I think it was a pretty good year. I had some close calls with cash flow issues on the business side, but that's simply my own deal. I can't blame that on anybody but me and failing to plan ahead for certain things. One of those things is some increased sales. Now, I've looked at my sales figures for the year, and I'm fairly even with last year, which is fine considering what it could have been. We've knocked products off the line and that kind of thing. But I look at the overall picture. I want to, you know, zoom out from my personal stuff and just say that looking at the big picture of what's going on with the country and with things that are going on, I'm pretty happy with what I'm seeing. There are things that could be a lot better. For instance, I saw an article yesterday which kind of made me laugh, that people in the Senate, GOP Senate members, are essentially bombarding Trump's trade representative to drop some of his quote-unquote nationalism in negotiating some of these and renegotiating some of these trade compacts like NAFTA. You must stop being so American in your view and be more internationalist.
So wedded to getting an advantage for your own country.
Yes, exactly. We need to stop doing that. And it's like, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. And of course, it's the usual
gang.
They've
been conditioned to that, Chuck. That's the problem. We've had not 8 years, probably 16 to 20 years. Well, actually, let's go back even farther. They've probably had 30 to 40 years at the very least, and if you really want to go back, we could stretch it probably to 50 if you go back to Nixon and the detente with China, where U.S. trade representatives have basically come to the table saying, "What will you give us?" And then being happy, well, you know, we've got a great trade deal with this country. We're only losing, you know, X amount of dollars on the unit.
Yes.
There's a new sheriff in town. And a new way of thinking that actually is a businessman's way of thinking that, you know what, we want to be fair to each other, but I'm not going to be fair at the expense of losing something that I should be keeping. And so the U.S. trade representatives are cutting tougher deals now, and it's tougher only because we're not giving up the store to every comer and promising them the moon in order to say that we've got quote-unquote peace, you know, and a good trade relationship with these countries, which we all know we got great trade relationships, and then the UN then, you know, takes a vote, and all of a sudden we're on the short end of the stick on trade relationships. That's changing, too. I don't know if you saw this or not, Chuck. We talked about this on the program before. The Trump administration has decided to make the announcement. They made the announcement to move the United States Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Now, that really created a lot of hackles in the international community, raised them up, and they got all indignant because that means that Trump is saying that the U.S. is recognizing that Israel has rights to Jerusalem. It's not necessarily so, but, you know, it is a step in that direction. And the international community basically lost their composure over this. And, of course, the United Nations then decided they'd take a vote. And the vote was to condemn the move, to basically say that the U.S. had done bad. And, of course, in the past, you would have had a U.S. ambassador to the U.N., all except for maybe Alan Keyes. I think when he was U.S. ambassador to the U.N., he stood up pretty heavily, too. But pretty much every other U.S. ambassador to the United Nations folds like a cheap hand of cards. Not this ambassador, Nikki Haley, who was the former governor of South Carolina, who is our U.N. representative, our U.N. ambassador. Basically, Haley doubled down and said that, you know, the U.S. is going to be watching this vote, and we will reward those who stayed friends with us, and we will punish those who didn't. Well, that vote happened, Chuck, and I think it was 263 countries voted to condemn. 9 countries voted not to condemn, and then the other 54 countries either were absent or basically abstained from the vote. Well, I saw in an article that the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. had a holiday party where she invited the 64 other countries who didn't vote against the United States. And after the party, the next day announced that for 2018, the United States was going to reduce its quote-unquote contribution, or blood money,
yes,
to the United Nations by $285 million. Now, that sounds like an awful lot of money, but it's not considering how many billions of dollars we give to the United Nations every year. Plus, you know, the U.S. taxpayer, I think, takes it on the chin for that building in New York City setting there. The United Nations.
Oh yeah, we pay offices. That. Yeah.
We pay that. So, a new administration, new sheriff in town, changing the way they do business, and there are a number of countries now who are starting to finally wake up and say, you know what? I don't think we can treat them like a redheaded stepchild anymore. As a matter of fact, there have been 2 or 3 countries already that have announced they're moving their embassies from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, along with the United States. Guatemala was the most recent country to do so, and then I think there were a couple of countries. I don't think any of the majors, like Germany.
I think you're going to find Central European countries are sort of flocking to that flag.
Central European countries, that's right.
Poland, probably Hungary. I'm stating these off the top of my head, and I'd have to confirm them. However, if you look at, for instance, what's going on in Hungary and Poland, Poland and Hungary are not fooling around. They go, we know what a Muslim conquest and invasion looks like from several hundred years of our history, and we're not going to have it here again. We've had it here once. We don't want it anymore. And so they're sort of seeing this as a sort of repudiation of that particular viewpoint, that it's we really just got to let people come here, show our Christian love by having these people who hate us come here and be inculcated into society. Well, what does that do to your society? Obviously, it's no longer the same kind of society that you had before. Because waves of immigration change societies. There's no doubt about that, Barry. All you got to do is look at American culture. I'm not saying this for good or bad. I am the result, and I think you're the result of waves of European immigration, right? I mean...
Actually, it's interesting you say that because, as you know, we just got through Christmas. And I can talk about this. My mother-in-law is big into genealogy. And so she's done an awful lot of research on her family. As a matter of fact, she and her daughter, my wife, are writing a book on their family. But for Christmas, I received, we got this shipped to us in the mail. It was this big tube, and we opened the tube up. It was this big poster on photo paper, and you unrolled it, and it was our family tree. My wife's family tree going back on her side and my family tree going back on my side if counting our kids being there in the middle of the family tree, it was basically 6 generations.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, and she did all this research and of course she gave us 2 copies to one to share with my parents. And so my parents got that, nicely framed as a Christmas present. And we got, ours here. And I got to looking at it. And on my mother's side, I trace my heritage back to Ireland and environs. And on my father's side, it traces back, I think we've been here a little longer. So going back to that sixth generation, the earliest I had an ancestor born was like 1795 on that chart. And most of them were already here, in America. So I'm very interested in possibly tracing some of those lines back a little farther and see if I can go back another generation or two. But of course, doing that, that was, you have to come up with, there were, 32 ancestors, the husbands and wives listed in that sixth generation. So, I'm going to have to look up 64 and then 128 different lines back to see if I can go back and see how far my heritage traces back on my side. I'm sure that England and maybe Germany and other places are tied up into mine. Well, most of them on my, especially my father's side, were already in America as of the, late 18th century. So, well,
your last name is Sheets, and that's not exactly a good English name.
No, it's more of a German name.
It's German.
But I think, but there were a number of others in my family line that I'm sure trace back through England.
Well, guess what? My family has Sheets in it.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that it probably does.
Yeah,
we're everywhere.
Yeah. Now my mother's maiden name was Norton, and she traced she tried to join the DAR at one point. And she traced an ancestor back to about the 1740s. Now, the name Norton is Welsh. And they were able to get as far back as a relative who was a doctor who lived in the Philadelphia area from about the 1740s. A lot of people, there was a huge wave of immigration in the 1740s. A lot of them were Scots, because of the Bonnie Prince Charlie rebellion. A lot of Scots came over here. But that being said, my ancestors came over, and my mom traced them. And it turns out that this doctor from Philadelphia, who was my mom's direct ancestor, was a Quaker and was a non-combatant in the Revolution, but had given aid in the form of medical treatment and that kind of thing, and providing food for the men at Valley Forge.
Okay.
Which and then it turns out that we've somewhere in the family tree branch, someplace, we're related to Mad Anthony Wayne.
Oh,
if
wow!
Who Mad Anthony Wayne is, Anthony Wayne was a cavalry general under Washington.
Yep.
Somewhere my mom told me a long time ago, and that information is long lost. I'd have to redo it all, but yeah, we're sort of more indirectly related to him. There's an intermarriage someplace with that family.
Right. Oh, so, cool. I know that I knew of at least one military officer in my lineage, because it was Colonel something or other. I have to go back and take a look at it. This thing, it was a poster, but it didn't come with like all the background history stuff that my mother-in-law has been doing. So I'm going to be working on that. But from his dates of birth and death, he was around before the Civil War. So therefore, he probably served, if he was a colonel, he may have served in the Mexican War.
Oh, yeah. There are lots of Nortons in the Northern Army.
Yes.
We've got pictures of, we don't have them. We have relatives on my mom's side. Now, the Michaelis family is a little different. As near as we can tell, our family came over in the 1880s wave, settled in West Virginia and south eastern Ohio.
Okay.
I know my grandfather was born in Marietta, so somewhere in that vicinity, but they haven't been here quite as long. So I've got fairly recent German immigration. Michaelis is German. I've had a number of people. It's interesting. I'll get people. We had a couple, one of our elders, who's now an elder emeritus at our church, was from Germany. He and his wife were Germans. And he says, well, you know, you're not pronouncing that right. And I said, yeah, I know. The correct pronunciation is like Michaelis. And he said, yes, that's it. That's it exactly. But he looked at me and he said, your people are from southern Germany. Probably. And I said, okay, what makes you think so? And he says, well, you resemble people who are descendants of Italians who came in with the Romans and stayed in southern Germany. He said, your profile, your face shape, the tone of your skin, he said, you're a little darker. I said, yeah. He said, yeah, you are probably actually originally Italian, but you've, of course, melded, your people melded in with Germany, and you're probably like Bavaria or a Swabian, you know, some southern area of Germany. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Yeah, someday, maybe, in my spare time, I'll check that out. So, yeah, does immigration, you know, we started out talking about how immigration can change a culture. Does immigration change a culture? Well, gosh, look at the differences in American society between 1800 and 1900. Did mass immigration change a society? Oh my gosh, yes. You bet it did. And, you know, while America is the great melting pot for the most part, there are still communities that are set up, you know, what we all joke about stuff about each other. You know, my wife and I are all constantly telling each other, well, your little Prussian point is coming out on top of your head. You've got the spiked helmet on today. And I said, well, my family wasn't Prussian. So, you know, and Italians kid each other and call each other Paisan and that kind of stuff. We all do that. But when you look into all our backgrounds, man, we are a mix. If your family's been here long enough, you got every kind of blood there is available. And when I say blood, I mean DNA. That's why I kind of laugh about, you know, I am a biochemist, and I have had some DNA training. It's been a long, 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 long time ago. Let me tell you, in DNA technology, 30 years ago is a very, very long time ago. But when I look at these Ancestry.com things and look at these people that are looking up what their family DNA makeup is, I always laugh at that. Well, you're from, you know, you're 28% from here and 12% from there and blah, 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 blah. You can't tell that close. Europeans have been moving around the globe, and Asians have been moving around the globe, and Africans have been moving around the globe. You know, Spanish people, there's a lot of Moorish blood mixed in, which is North African. And in that North African blood, there's a lot of Central African blood. And in that Central African blood, there's a lot of Southern African blood. It's just silly to say, here's what your ancestry is. And you get these ads with people who are wearing lederhosen, and I thought I was German, and then they find out, oh, but I'm like 68% Irish. So then he drops his hobby of doing all this German stuff and goes over to doing Irish stuff. And I'm like, what's the point? I don't do stuff. I must have some Scottish blood. That's all I can say is because I love the sound of bagpipes. Okay. That's fine. I'm pretty sure I do have some Scottish blood. But so what? I'm an American. I was born in the United States of America. I'm an American. I don't care what your race is. I don't care what your national ethnic makeup is. I don't care what your color is. If you were born here, you're a citizen of here. You have the rights and the privileges and the duties of citizenship of the United States of America. And welcome to the club. I get a little tired of some of this separating by ethnicity. It's part of the, you know, biblically speaking, God says there is no race except those who are the property of Jesus Christ and those who are not. That is the racial divide, and that has nothing to do with skin color.
Right, and that's because there's only one, you know, the scriptures say, Paul says, that we are all of one blood, and so that's... that there's only one race, it's the human race. We are of different ethnicities, we are of different regional preferences, but we are all of one blood. And of course, you know, we have different skin tones and different habits and things of that nature, but, you know, we are still all made from the first parents, Adam and Eve. You know, everybody descends from there. And then we just through time and through migration and through other, mixings of the various tribes, as they call them in the scriptures, we end up with the various ethnicity. Again, Chuck, you know, I've always railed at the idea that, and Christians do this just as much as anybody else does, is that we fall into the what is a Marxist false dialectic regarding this idea of there being multiple races. Because if you can get someone to basically balkanize themselves by skin color and then say, X, Y, and Z happened to me because of my race. Well, no, we're all the same race. We all have the same things. Now, do people treat each other the same? No, of course not, because that's sin. That's sin in our lives, and we do that. And you know, and we have a tendency because we've been, whether actively educated in or subtly indoctrinated in, to affinity to our own tribe, i.e., sticking with those who are like you, both in appearance, image, attitude, behavior, etc. That's just the natural way that, again, I say natural in the sense of it's human nature to do that. We tend to cling to our own tribes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a natural thing to do, and it's not necessarily bad until you become xenophobic.
Right.
And when you do that, now, again, I fear no foreigner. I do fear, and I don't necessarily fear cultural change, because let's face it, the culture that we have now, boy, could it stand to change? What kind of change would I like to see? Well, it has nothing to do with would I like to bring in more from this country and not from that country. That's not the point. The point is that the kind of cultural change I fear is the kind that we've already got, and that is a change away from recognizing the power of God, that God is to be respected, and His Son is the conduit from whom His grace flows unto us through the ministrations of the Holy Spirit. That's the kind of cultural change I fear, and I have watched that cultural change go on in my lifetime. I have watched the culture change from a culture that was a church going and most businesses closed on Sunday when I was, up until the time I was a teenager, to now Sunday being the busiest shopping day of the year. And very few people going, most people worshiping either at Our Lady of St. Mattress in Box Springs, or doing their worship by going out into nature and walking around a beautifully cultivated and landscaped place called a golf course. It's a very dangerous way of thinking, and it's just a sign that we have abandoned as a culture the idea that we should be giving our worship to God. Look, He's only really asked for worship on one day a week out of seven. That's not a lot. Does that necessarily mean that you're going to be in church the whole day? No, it doesn't. Some of you will think the 2 hours you maybe spend in your church service is enough, and some people may want to go back on Sunday evenings. And some people do spend the whole afternoon in church. If there are some churches, I've known people who've attended churches like this that they have preachers that preach in relays on Saturday or on Sunday afternoon, start in the morning and end up in the evening, and they preach in relays, and you can come and go and, you know, have a meal and that kind of thing while this preaching is going on. That's another way of handling that kind of thing. Would I like to see America come back into a situation where she wanted, not forced to, but wanted to give worship to her God on every Sabbath day? And the answer is, I'd love to see that. That is a matter of a mindset. That is a matter of a personal preference. God has mandated it. Do you respect Him or not? That's the question.
Well, and again, that's something that we're going to have to look at as the culture is shifting, hopefully, and I see a number of instances where I think the culture is starting to shift back a little bit.
Yes, I do too.
And sadly enough, it's some part of it's keyed to the political environment that we're in. But overall, though, I think what you're finding is that there's an entire generation of people who have come up and have realized the emptiness and the lack of fulfillment that's in the modern secular religion, so to speak. Now, there are some who haven't gotten a hold of that yet, and we see that almost all the time in the media, et cetera, as they blaspheme God's name and do other things that are... Well, sacrilegious is a hardly used term anymore, but that would be considered, heretical or sacrilegious. And it isn't just in the media, and it isn't just entertainment. I mean, you see this in the church as well. But, our program today is not so much to, go after all the things that are wrong. But I think as well as at the end of this year that things are, have changed. Now, again, we talked a little bit about the economics. But I think socially as well. I mean, yes, you've had some significant issues that have raised concern. You had the church shooting and the big church shooting in Texas. You had the mass attack or shooting in Las Vegas. You've had all of these things, but oftentimes when we get down to it, those are key to more. In the one, I think in the Las Vegas attack, it seems like it was more a political statement than anything else. And in the Houston church shooting, or the church shooting outside of Houston, that was more of a personal family dispute, where the gunman was actually after the family of his ex, and just happened to pick the Sunday that they didn't happen to be at church, and sadly enough to many others, ultimate end, sadly. But other than those things, though, I think what you've seen is there's a change in the dialogue. And it's, and if you cut through all of the garbage with, Russian collusion and the sexual harassment stuff, which I think has kind of had its half-life, I think, has deteriorated. And I hate to say that in the sense that I'm not trying to discount the real problems that are faced by many people, men and women alike, whether in the workplace or in the pursuits of their careers, in actually being treated poorly, and/or treated like an object, or asked or coerced to do things in order to get ahead, quote unquote. But ultimately, I think that what happened is that once it started becoming clearer that the vast majority of people who were being exposed for this sexual assault, sexual harassment, turned out to be liberal icons, the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, the Dustin Hoffmans, all of a sudden, then, you don't hear so much about that now. I mean, it like peaked and just quickly went away. Now, of course, we have a couple of sitting officials in the United States Congress who are leaving office, I think, by next week. I've heard that Al Franken and John Conyers both are going to be leaving because of this situation. Of course, you've had a couple others, but I think there's Blake Fahrenthold, who's a Republican, and Trent Franks, who both have also stepped down from their seats due to inappropriate comments, et cetera.
Well, there's one from Texas. Can't think of
it. Well, that was Fahrenthold. That's Blake Fahrenthold.
There's another one.
Okay, there may be another one. That one I probably didn't hear about. But that's starting. But you're starting to see that kind of now that it's looking more like it's harming the liberal enclave more than it's harming conservatives, all of a sudden it's not such a big issue anymore. I mean, I don't see it as much in the media. It's not in your face every day now. you know, what is in your face is, you know, things like the Gallup poll saying that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are the what most admired man and woman in America in 2017. Did you see that? It came out just, I think it was just yesterday, and said that according to their polling, the most admired individuals in America for men were Barack Obama and, or the male was Barack Obama and the female was Hillary Clinton. Now, I have to stop and ask myself, where did they do these polls? I mean, yes, if you did them in New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles, yeah, you might come out with that.
Okay, Gallup is infamous. It's a Gallup poll. Gallup is infamous. Oh, by the way, the other congressman was Joe Barton, and he has not resigned, but he's being pressured to resign.
Mm-hmm.
But Gallup is infamous for oversampling. Now, what do I mean by oversampling? By grossly oversampling, for instance, people on one side of the political aisle versus another. And Gallup poll is infamous for oversampling Democrats. What's the purpose of oversampling? Well, it's obvious. To get results that you want. And the result they wanted was for Barack Obama to be one of the most admired men in America. Did they ask that question in the heartland? My guess is no. That they oversampled East and West Coast.
Right, because I really don't see where, and they probably oversampled in areas that were liberal enclaves too. And again, believe you me, if you create a poll, you can shape it to come out with the outcomes you want it to come out with. That's kind of the little dirty inside of polling is a poll is only good as the objectivity of the questions that are asked.
Exactly. It's exactly how you ask the questions and who you ask. For instance, as we know from the 2016 election, when you oversample Democrats and you only take polls in states that you know are reliably blue, you're going to show that Hillary Clinton is going to win in a landslide.
Yes.
Did Hillary Clinton win in a landslide? No.
Probably not.
She got more votes, but she got more votes by grossly running over the top of Trump in places like California and New York City. All of her overvotes came from results like 68 to 32 in places that have a high population but are very limited in scope, geographically squeezed, if you will. In other words, all her margin came from New York City and the California vote. Well, that's exactly what the Electoral College was designed to eliminate. Those kinds of results. The big population centers running roughshod over the heartland. It's exactly, it's why the little states forced the big states into the compromise with the Electoral College. And now we have people trying to eliminate it, like Robert Reich is currently out there screaming and jumping up and down that we have to eliminate the Electoral College. Well, I think the Electoral College is one of the most positive things, some of the most positive results you can point to. Again, as bad as George W. Bush was from 2001 until 2009, he did originally win his seat with a minority of the popular vote, and I think Al Gore would have been a disaster.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, again, and that gets down to it. Okay, and, you know, if you ask the average person, would you want to have someone in office who was elected by the overall will of all of the people of the country, or do you want someone in office who was elected based upon being able to sway mass population centers only?
Yes.
Because that's the difference between the Electoral College and something like a national popular vote, which basically, if national popular vote had their way, then whoever wins the popular vote in their state wins all of their electors, And that's usually the way it works. Well, they'd get away with it. Basically, it doesn't matter. If you won the national vote, you win, regardless of how many electors. Now, in this case with Clinton and Trump, that would have been a great injustice because, as you know, the Trump's campaign actually did a very significantly impressive strategy. And they managed to win in small states and in medium-sized states where the total add-ups of their electoral votes came up to 332. They need 270 to win. They got 332 electoral votes. Now, did Hillary Clinton get more popular votes by winning large, obscenely skewed percentages in areas like Los Angeles and New York City and Chicago? Yeah, absolutely.
Yep, exactly.
There's no doubt about it. There was, I think it's a 2 million vote differential. But that's exactly the reason why the founders put the Electoral College in place in the first place, was to prevent the larger population states from controlling everything in some sort of a block against all of the smaller states. It was a protection for the smaller states to have a say in national elections. And without it, then states like Iowa and Montana and Wyoming and New Hampshire and Vermont should all just stay home because it won't matter. No matter who they vote for, whoever in L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, Dallas, Houston, Miami, and New York City vote for is going to be the next national leader. That would not reflect or represent the will of the people of the United States. The Electoral College is to try to, as best as you can, balance those competing interests, large states, small states, large population areas, lighter population areas, so that at the end of the day, the overall mean is that you have an elected official, a president in this case, who is a representative of the large number of the American citizenry. And again, polls like this Gallup poll, like where they oversample for certain demographics, don't reflect what the American people are actually believing, thinking, feeling, or acting upon. And that's a big problem with these polls, Chuck. You know, if you take a look at another poll, the end of the year poll showing that Donald Trump has a 45% positive, you know, favorability rating. It's exactly the same as Barack Obama's was at the end of his first year, of his first term. So if Barack Obama is the most admired person in America in 2017, Donald Trump's on a path to become the most admired person in America after the year after he finishes two terms in office for himself.
Well, Barry, I think you and I both know that's never going to be allowed to happen.
I'm not so sure that there's so much allowing going on anymore, Chuck.
Well,
they're trying, and we saw that in Alabama with the Roy Moore situation where the establishment Republicans dumped $30 to $40 million in there to basically scar and wound a candidate so badly that he definitely lost to a liberal Democrat in a state he shouldn't have lost in, but then turned around and blamed him for it and, like, are shocked why a Democrat won in this deep red state. And it's like, okay, come on, let's
well,
not get ourselves.
That's like Mitch McConnell coming out and blaming Steve Bannon for the loss of the reddest of red seats. You guys put, the Senate campaign fund essentially
Senate Republican Leadership Committee
SRLC. By the way, when they send you something for the Senate Republican Leadership Committee, throw it away, because who it goes to is who Mitch McConnell wants to be elected, not who necessarily you should want to be elected. They withdrew their support because of what turned out to be a bogus accusation. And there are people still out there in Republican circles who were saying, well, Roy Moore was just weird. Well, I got news. In the South, 40 years ago, it was not weird for men in their 30s to go out with girls who were 18 years old. Sorry, it wasn't weird then. I know lots, and in fact, my brother's in-laws were something like 16 or 18 years apart. I know I can think of my wife's college roommate. She and her husband.
Let me throw you a couple of names out there that the left conveniently likes to try to forget about when they talk about this: Jerry Seinfeld, Woody Allen. Both men who, in their more mature years, were dating and or married to girls who were half their age or less.
Jerry Seinfeld was dating a girl named Shoshana Lonstein, who was about 18 or 19 years old, and he was 31 or 32.
Oh, he was older than that. I think when he started dating her, he might have been like near 40.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly.
And of course, Woody Allen's situation basically was, you know, onerous, where he had
it was
basically
his,
became
was
romantically
his adopted,
linked with a stepdaughter.
It was the adopted daughter of his wife. Did he marry Mia Farrow? His girlfriend, anyway.
Yeah, they were married.
Very, very salacious. Now, I'm going to give you another example that maybe you haven't thought about. There is a congresswoman named Pat Dingell from Michigan. Pat Dingell is married to the former holder of that seat, John Dingell. John Dingell was born in 1926. Pat Dingell was born in 1953. There's 26 years difference between their ages. And Pat Dingell also, interestingly enough, used to be a Republican before she married John Dingell. And they've been married... Gosh, they got married somewhat late, but it doesn't matter. There's 26 years difference. Look, this age difference thing was Roy Moore. I don't want to go too far into this, but Roy Moore was not weird. And in fact, the woman, you'll notice Gloria Allred went radio silent after the woman came out and admitted, yeah, I did forge part of that.
Okay, now let's just put this in everybody's thinking cap. Who else went radio silent right after Doug Jones won the election on December the 12th? Every last one of Roy Moore's accusers have dropped off the face of the planet.
Well, there's
radio silent.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, it's no longer man bites dog. Now it's dog bites man. There's so many sexual harassment complaints out there. There was a woman who came out who just accused Corey Lewandowski of doing something at some party someplace. And if you look at this woman's background, she's like she's a singer involved in some kind of sadomasochistic stuff, says that he slapped her on the behind. Well, okay, a slap on the behind is not sexual assault. I've been talking to my daughters about this. And let's face it, there's... Probably not a woman on the planet, well, a woman in the United States of America who has not had some kind of an aggressive sexual advance made upon them. Does normalcy make it right? That's a good thing, Barry. This is one of those retrospective things that's good. How are men, biblically speaking, supposed to treat women?
We're supposed to treat them as being fellow heirs to the grace of Christ.
With respect, the respect due a fellow human being and a person who is, that's right, heir to the inheritance of Jesus Christ, whether they're Christian or not. You can't automatically make the assumption that they're not. That being said, how have men, what has the, this is another look back kind of thing. Who just died this year?
Well, that's a good question, because there's probably been quite a few who've died.
Think about somebody who was heavily involved in the quote-unquote sexual revolution.
Okay.
Hugh Hefner.
Hugh Hefner, that's right. Okay, yes, I was just about to get there.
Yeah. Hugh Hefner died this year. Was he a major contributor what are we not seeing the legacy of Hugh Hefner playing out?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely we are.
No doubt.
We're seeing a combination, believe it or not, of Hugh Hefner coupled with feminism. Because what did that deadly combination do? What it did was it basically said, okay, men are fine to go out and satisfy their predatory instincts. Because after all, women are liberated, and they should want to be as predatory as we are. Is that still the case? Is this not?
No, it shouldn't be.
Exactly. Is this not the backlash of that?
There is a big part to that, but it's interesting because that's the one thing that most of the people who are trying to drive this, and whether it's the Me Too group, you know, you saw on Time Magazine the pictures of all of these folks in the Me Too thing, not a single one of them has actually done something which even a proto-feminist back in the 70s, Andy Ridge Workin, actually put together, was the connection of pornography and the objectification of women and how that actually was hurting feminism, not helping it. But what you have in the modern feminist movement is, you know, the movement toward the pornification of everyday life, even to the point of fighting for, and you see this oftentimes out of these feminists, not only fighting for abortion on demand, but also fighting for the legalization of what they call sex work or prostitution becoming legal.
Yeah. Sex worker. No, they're not a sex worker. They're a prostitute. There are, you know, you can play this game by using different language to try to make it more palatable. It's not palatable. It's prostitution. And in fact, it's an exploitation of men. When you get down to the bottom line, it really is an exploitation of men. What makes it an exploitation of men? The fact that there are men who are willing to part with money or services or goods or favors of a different kind to women to have access to their bodies. I mean, these are facts. And feminists have always tried to paint it as, well, that's why men get married. Well, I mean, that's part of the reason men get married, because they want to be with women. Is that a bad thing, to want to be with women? No, it's how you get the job done. If you commit to a woman and commit to one woman and to be with her your entire life, it's a little bit different than paying her or giving her something or providing a good or service for a series of temporary assignations. It's vastly different. And it is the pornification of the way we view male-female relationships. Is that a major problem? Yes, it is, but it's sort of working its way out with this. It's like women have gotten into this, the idea that they can use their bodies. In fact, this is third wave feminism, using their bodies as a power lever, if you will. They use it as a lever. It works fine until they're, you know, maybe in their mid-40s. And then as they become less desirable sexually, then they begin to lose that power. Well, if they had gained their power on the basis of their completely on the basis of their capabilities and not sold it as part of a package with the body that comes with it, that's an entirely different thing. You know, women who all you got to do is pick up a feminist magazine and see a dress for the boardroom. And if you look at some of the things that are recommended that they dress for the boardroom in, you're like, wow. If you're trying to draw attention away for the men from what they're supposed to be thinking about, you're going to get the job done. Now, there are other women who dress conservatively and just want to be taken on their merits. That's fine. Good. If you can do the job, do it. But don't necessarily use your other assets to as a power source. And yet women are told to do that. Well, what happens to the poor women who haven't been given that particular power source? Are they left out in the cold? Apparently. It's a bad cultural way of thinking of things. Here we go back to the cultural thing. It's a bad way culturally to think about things. Women should be treated as equals in the workplace. And men Because we've gotten away from the biblical thing of treating women with respect, and you know, almost every man's guilty of it at one time or another. You know, earlier on in their dumb days, or you know, you've thought about women from an objectified perspective rather than as a person. And we're working that out. That's a good thing. And that's why the retrospective and thinking about people who have turned the culture the wrong direction. It was actually nice to see that Hugh Hefner was sort of thought of as an anachronism and sort of a just basically a dirty old man when he died. That's a good thing, I think.
Yes, it is. And honestly, I think that that's what you're going to find as people start realizing that, you know, there's more to life than you're chasing after your desires, chasing after, you know, this false fulfillment, which can only be found in Christ. And, you know, we've talked about that numerous times on this program, even to the point where I think that, you know, it's funny because there was and I'm kind of segueing here just slightly, but just recently after the tax reform bill was signed, you know, the White House, the cabinet met. President Trump was at the center of the table, and he basically announced that they were going to open the cabinet meeting in prayer. And the media was in the room, and I guess he looked up the media and he goes, "We're going to pray now, guys." He goes, "And it may help you out a lot." and then Ben Carson, you know, opened in prayer, things of that nature. And of course, people were you know, making some fun of it, you know, that he was chiding the media. But, you know, really what he was doing is he's actually pointing out that, yes, there's only one thing that can bring contentment, fulfillment, and that is Christ. That is having that relationship with God in prayer. And I bring that up because you ran across an article that we want to talk about here to close out. Over at the American Thinker by Tom Lifson, who basically wrote an article called Stage 4 of Trump Derangement.
Yes, yeah.
And so why don't we go into that a little bit? I mean, I think this is interesting because that's what a lot of liberals and establishment Republicans and never-Trumpers, you know, at this point in time, after this year, after seeing the accomplishments of a man that they hated and they've tried to tear down, seeing the fact that the signature piece of tax reform, of all of the things that have happened with the appointments and the nominations to the judiciary that are solid and conservative, of the actions taken, as we've seen, ISIS has lost 98% of the territory that they took while Barack Obama was president. In the last year, the caliphate has almost been completely annihilated. There are countries that are taking back their countries from ISIS because a new administration, a new way of thinking, and they went in and they basically went in with a mission of, we're not here to just maintain the status quo, we're here to fix the problem.
Right.
And you know, so these are things going on, but progressives and all these folks that I named have a thing called Trump Derangement Syndrome, TDS. So, and Chuck, you know, you saw this, so yeah, why don't you run with it here for a minute?
Well, this Lifson article is very good in that he makes the statement that progressives love to adopt what they call a public health perspective on things they oppose, such as possession of a firearm. This results in pediatricians asking parents if they have the gun in their house, among other oddities. And yes, that happened to us, and I said, it's none of your business. Two can play that game. It's time to face the mass psychosis that has swept the at-risk population of the nation since the election of Donald Trump as president. Here's what he says. It's pretty clear that the first stages of TDS include... Go ahead.
Hey, hang on just a second, John. I just want to throw in one little thing here. I've always had a saying, an old buddy of mine and I who worked in the State House always had a saying together that anytime a politician says that it's either for public health or for the children, grab your wallet and your freedom because you're about to lose both of them.
Yeah, run. Run. Take them and run. Okay, here's what Lifson says. It's pretty clear that the first stages of TDS, Trump Derangement Syndrome, include denial. Attributing Trump's electoral victory to Russian hacking is the most common manifestation. But another common manifestation of the syndrome is electoral college denial. Quote, Hillary won a majority of votes, so she should be president, unquote. No, that's not the way the electoral college works. And someday we'll do a whole show on the electoral college and talk about it. Two, anger at Trump supporters. Disparagement of Trump voters as unworthy fools whose misguided thoughts brought us a disaster. This is matched by anger at Trump supporters among political commentators. And we see that all over the place. Number three, shunning of former colleagues with the bad taste to support Trump. In fairness, this is a two-way street, as Kurt Schliester quips, and this is kind of funny because Schliester was anti-Trump. As 2017 comes to a close, tumbleweeds roll down the empty Lido deck while the Republican base answers the question, what if Conservative Inc. gave a cruise and nobody came? The Lido deck, of course, is a deck on a ship for recreation and that kind of thing. And the answer is nobody did come. Conservative Inc. gave a cruise and nobody came. Thank you very much. Number four is conversion. As the first three factors combine, and if no countervailing thoughts are allowed entry into the TDS sufferer's brain for reasons we do not understand yet, we get signs of actual ideological conversion. Once the virus of liberalism reaches the brain, progress can be devastating. Here's something that Bill Kristol, here's an example that Bill Kristol tweeted. This should shock no one who knows William Kristol's background and his actual political thought process. Here, quote, the GOP tax bill's bringing out my inner socialist. The sex scandals are bringing out my inner feminist. Donald Trump and Roy Moore are bringing out my inner liberal. What is happening? Well, the answer
is becoming honest with himself.
He has finally becoming honest with himself. And this from Max Boot, who suddenly discovered white privilege because of Donald Trump. No kidding. Writing in Foreign Policy. Foreign Policy is the magazine of the CFR, the
Council on Foreign Relations.
Quote, it has become impossible for me to deny the reality of discrimination, harassment, even violence that people of color and women continue to experience in modern day America from a power structure that remains for the most part in the hands of straight white males. People like me, in other words, whether I realize it or not, I have benefited from my skin color and my gender, and those of a different gender or sexuality or skin color have suffered because of it. This sounds obvious, but it wasn't clear to me until recently. I've had my consciousness raised seriously. The larger problem of racism in our society was made evident in Donald Trump's election. If you know anything about Max Boot, he is a former hero of the conservative movement. For some reason, I've read some of his stuff, and I thought it was plumb awful.
I've read a few things, and it's basically garbage.
Yes, it's imperialist. It's imperialistic drivel, militaristic, imperialistic nonsense.
He was a favorite of the neocon.
He's a neocon favorite. Is there any recovery possible when TDS reaches this late stage? Does it permanently disable perception and logic? Well, apparently. My hopeful prognosis is that remission is possible. Jonah Goldberg, for example, despite early disdain for Trump and membership in the National Review editorial staff, which was a never-Trump enclave, has retained his ability to make distinctions and even find praiseworthy actions by President Trump on occasion. This coming year, with the likelihood of prosperity fired by deregulation and tax reform, will be a test. I expect those never-Trumps who have not developed an immune reaction in the cerebral cortex will recover, while those unable to get beyond their own failure to understand Trump's electoral victory and subsequent triumphs will lapse further into their delusions. Eventually, they will come to admire Rosie O'Donnell, which ought to be the marker for the terminal stage. That's just too good, Barry.
Yeah, it is.
That's just too good. And, of course, unfortunately, that's going to be our retrospective for the year because we're out of time. We will post a link to that that article because it's too good not to read. And the commentary is pretty good too. So that being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.